One of Father Carl's more dramatic stories concerned an incident that occurred at his theological college, St Stephen's House, Oxford. One of the Church of England's leading exorcist clergy had been invited to the college to give a how-to teaching session to some of the students. As it turned out, everyone who attended got rather more than they'd bargained for. The exorcist priest gathered the attendees together in the library. At one point in his exposition, he recited the prayer for the casting out of an evil spirit from a spiritually contaminated place, whereupon one of the students, who had a somewhat notorious private life, fell on the floor and began rolling around while uttering guttural growlings and blood-curdling screams. "Quick, boys, get down on your knees and we'll say the Lord's Prayer together," called out the exorcist. The ambulance was called and the afflicted student was taken away, never to return. This unusual incident was the beginning of a clean-out and reform process at St Stephen's House, Oxford. I sometimes think how useful it would have been if, when the bishop laid hands on me in Peterborough Cathedral, I'd arisen to my feet afterwards, imbued with the kind of miraculous powers that Jesus had. We might be having healing services here at St Peter's on Saturday evening, at which many would be wonderfully restored to health and would return the next morning to give thanks to God and his holy house. I might be able to clear out the ward for the criminally insane at Wakery with mighty acts of deliverance. And when attending wardens' meetings at the People's Warden's House at St Leonard's, I might be able to take a shortcut by walking across the harbour. Speculation like this, of course, explains why it's highly unlikely that I'll ever have these kind of miraculous powers conferred on me. God knows the flaws and weaknesses in my character all too well, and knows also the considerable risks of me becoming drunk with spiritual power and doing foolish and dangerous things. It's no coincidence that the baptism of Christ is followed immediately by the temptations of Christ in the wilderness, where he was tested to the limits in a sorting out process to ensure that he would be immune to any unwise or inappropriate use of divine power. There's another difference between Jesus and me, his quality of being. He was conceived by the Holy Spirit, and that gave him what we call a different ontological basis, or way of being in the world, or way of being human. He was divinely human. He was built along divine lines, constituted as God by nature, whereas we can only become godlike by participation if we make a considerable success of our Christian life. Although Jesus was Son of God as well as Son of Mary, his quiet growing up years at this stage were not marked by any miracles. They were not required at this stage, nor was he in a position to work them. These were the years of his hidden silent life at Nazareth. This is what came to an end at his baptism. That event at the River Jordan brings to an end the long silence from God that had troubled the Jewish people from the time of the end of the age of the prophets. They wondered if God had forgotten them. Now a very different kind of divine disclosure takes place. As God the Father speaks from heaven, he declares Jesus to be a son. He reveals himself also as the author of all that Jesus will do as son. Indeed, this is an act of the Holy Trinity revealing itself in time. Crucially, the Holy Spirit is revealed as the one who from now on will inwardly direct and inwardly empower Jesus as Son to perform his saving deeds in communion with him. The Holy Spirit now switches on the capacity of Jesus to perform miracles as a follow-on from this inward direction of him along Spirit-filled lines. Discussion about miracles often gets bogged down in consideration of the appropriateness or possibility of interfering and interrupting the laws of nature. This is not helpful in getting to the point of why miracles were a crucial part of the ministry of Jesus. Acts of healing and of deliverance from demonic powers flesh out and authenticate the teaching ministry of Jesus. They are dramatic examples of the rolling back of the power of sin and evil in its mischief-making capacity to generate human misery. They are show-and-tell examples of what life will be like in the kingdom that Jesus so often speaks about, the place and space where God rules and where sickness and sadness have been banished. There is a time transfer issue at work here too. The Epistle to the Hebrews defines prayer as appropriating by faith the powers of the age to come. The miracles of Jesus, and for that matter, those carried out by the church today, are small packets of the future fulfilled time when God will be all in all, transported back in time into the present where they upend the distorted and gone wrong bits of our world and reorder them to their true nature. They are the first fruits and down payments of the way things will be in the kingdom. They reassure us and give us hope for the future, that no matter how dark things appear now, God will have the last word and will sort things out in the future. They show in microcosm the way things will be, the way things ought to be, when the world glistens with the freshness and vitality of a restored creation. I like the way Rowan Williams puts it when he talks about matter yielding up its true and deeper nature as a result of God-generated miracles. The somewhat hard and inert nature of matter becomes transparent and translucent to the action of God, an agent and ally of his purposes by his word of command and his grace-filled touch. Why have I stressed the role of miracles in the ministry of Jesus as a follow-on consequence of his baptism? What implications does this have for our Christian walk in the week ahead? This was not someone to be trifled with or underestimated as just a kind person calling us to live a good life. His mastery over the forces of nature, his ability to raise even the dead, and his capacity to reverse even the most entrenched forms of human suffering reveal him for what he is, the God-man Jesus Christ walking this earth intent on crushing evil and calling us to a high destiny as junior sons and daughters of God. He swallowed the darkness of human God-forsakenness, going boldly to a tragic death, that he might make it the door to union with God and eternal and joyful life in the kingdom. All this he accomplished by being accompanied by the Holy Spirit every step of the way in his ministry, and afterwards it was the Holy Spirit that raised him from death in the tomb. This week, it would be good for us to reflect each day on the ways in which we have been Spirit-accompanied in our lives. It will be different for each one of us. Do we have eyes to see how that has been and is occurring in our lives? This week I wrote in my journal, I have survived in ministry, though many I started out with or who were partners in ministry with me have fallen by the wayside or have given up or are dead. I marvelled at God's patience with me in all the tumults and turmoil of my life. I noted with appreciation how the Holy Spirit inwardly impelled me to go deeper in my faith and to learn more about it in seasons of renewal in my priesthood. I gave thanks for the ways in which God drew me closer to him in times of adversity, heartbreak, and defeat, so that these hard places in my life did not become occasions of turning away from him in bitterness and disappointment. Quite the reverse, I drew closer to him. The motto of the Royal Air Force is Per Ardua Ad Astra, through hard places to the stars. I'm thinking of adopting it as mine also.